now, all like, yeah.
Yeah. So they were like the OGs when it came down to somehow integrating blockchain into physical activity.
Not true, actually. I know Oleg very well. Okay. I met him and his family. He's in Portugal now. He made the move you should have done.
One of the moves,
And basically, they are called Sweatcoin. First time I met him at WeWork, South Bank, London. He told me about Sweatcoin. I'm like, so blockchain? And he's like, no, actually, no. So they are now going to blockchain with Sweat tokens.
So they never built on blockchain, right?
No. Which is incredible, right?
Totally incredible. I thought they were like, obviously you're calling it a coin. And it's like, okay. Is this like a bait and switch? But maybe that's okay. I don't know. But initially when I first heard the idea, I thought, wow, firstly crazy. But also I admire the craziness, because I think it was at the time, at that moment where everyone was just doing, oh, here's another wrinkle on the same thing. And he was actually trying to say, actually, everyone needs to get fit, and we need to incentivize the fitness somehow, and we can get companies to subsidize that. So, really good idea, and good to know he's actually moved to Portugal. So, if you see him, tell him I say hi. Anyway, I was in Cascais, is he? Very nice.
Yeah. How are you, by the way?
I'm okay, but people have not tuned in to listen to whether I'm okay, Pedro. They've tuned in to listen to Founders Focus, where we get up close and personal with the founders of technology companies that are changing the way in which we work today. This is episode 15, and I'm particularly pleased to be having this conversation, because this is actually quite an unusual one, because obviously, Pedro, you and I know each other very well, I think. As certainly from professional interactions and so on, and that's the first time of 15 episodes where I've interviewed someone who I actually know in advance of the conversation. Everyone previous, there's the first time I've met, it's kind of like let's discover and all this type of stuff. So this would be an interesting conversation. The entire idea is, how do we get to know Pedro Oliveira? What is his journey? What is his why is he doing what he's doing? And from there, we can learn a little bit more about this new vision with Town Protocol and what that's all about. So anyway, hopefully everyone can hear me okay. We'll just kick this straight off. So Pedro, let's just you're a busy man. Obviously, you've told me already you're busy. You got a young kid. You got a house reconstruction. You start a new business. Obviously, hyper busy, no time at all. What did you have to cancel today in order to jump onto Founders Focus with me today?
No, man, I always save some time for you, of course. Didn't cancel anything, honestly, obviously. No, before this call, I was in another one. I was pitching Talent Protocol this is interesting, for an investor syndicate. So they actually have their on-chain voting process
in order to invest.
It's called Own Fund, and I was pitching to them. Let's see if that goes well or not, because we did a couple of private raises. This is our final one, it was pitched just for that. But it's interesting to see that the VC model is getting disrupted by crypto, by Web3 as well. And as you know, VC also has a massive impact in talent. You know, a lot of talented people have been part of startups, scale-ups, unicorns, rhinos, horses, whatever you want to call the types of animals there. And they're all backed by VC money. So there's obviously a massive connection there. And it's great to see this disruption coming to them as well.
I think that the attractiveness of that immediately for me is this nature of sort of decentralized sentiment. So you can have the voting rather than have one person dictating what's happening. And I'm actually very sensitive to this, because obviously there's a political implication to it. We can see in politics it's generally a dissatisfactory sort of method of translating, what people generally are looking for to policy and execution. There's like seems to be like a very difficult way to do it, very inefficient. And one of the things that is attractive about Web3 is the idea maybe, you know, you can actually immediately connect the will of the people with the outcome that they're looking for. And perhaps that model is, you know, we need to see more of those models in more of those places and see where that goes. Okay, so we're going to learn all about Web3, blockchain and crypto and all that type of stuff throughout the course of today. But before we dive into the nitty-gritty of it, let's talk about your sort of situation, man, because this is the second time you've launched a kind of technology product as a founder. Did you always have it in your mind to set up a business, or was there a moment in your life when you realized actually being an employee is okay, but really I need to do this?
It's actually my third official.
I beg your pardon.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's my second official one in the HR technology space or talent technology space. But I actually had the one before landing.jobs. Was called Oops Booking, and was like a last minute booking system for travelers arriving at the airport without, housing or hotel or hostel. The thing was, that was when mobile was picking up.
And
it just stopped making sense. So it was for my investors, they invested $50,000. Obviously it went to shit, but I learned tons, and I'm still in touch with them today, so I think we're good. But before, to answer your question, how did this happen? I kind of see it like as a nurture and nature thing here. So from my mother's side, there's like a lot of entrepreneurship going on, not necessarily as like tech startups, obviously not as in tech startups, but other things, you know, relatable things, things that take risk to get there. So I can see that side having a role of sorts. But then nurture as well, like being in tech, so I studied computer science. Even though, like back in when I finished uni in 2009, so ages ago, we're fucking old, all of us. Sorry about the F word. So when that happened, so I was finishing uni in Lisbon, and startups wasn't a thing. Nobody knew what a startup was. You know, this is the raw truth. And then it started to happen, and we come a long way from this to, you know, where we are today in Lisbon and Portugal in general, with Web Summit, with Web3 being a hotspot. Obviously, the 0% tax on crypto helps. But I come from this space. So I had like a normal career, like dev, tech lead, you know, this type of career. And then I started to engage in startup events, and I realized, this is it. This is what I want.
I think sometimes that could be the key. Imagine if you were doing your tech job in a smaller town in Portugal that didn't have like an event scene or didn't have the proximity with other startups and other founders. You would never think about it, right? You think your ambition would purely be, okay, let's keep going up this tree. Let's keep doing the corporate stuff. Let's keep moving forward. And it needed that metropolitan space to get there. So I think that is that's a very interesting condition to think about, particularly when, you know, with COVID, everyone's thinking, look, is the city over? You know, do people now work entirely remotely? Is it a case that actually, you know, people no longer want to come in? But the reality of it is, for startups in particular, I think it's actually very, very useful just to have, you know, to accidentally bump into people. Like yesterday, I bumped into a bunch of people I haven't seen for years. One of them knew you, actually. And it was like, oh, who's that guy? Yeah, Pedro, I'm speaking to him tomorrow. And it was just like, okay, small world type scenario. But that small world wouldn't have existed. That small world would be genuinely not possible in a physically small world, if that makes any sense. It takes a big physical place for there to be a small world effect. Let's talk about you mentioned sort of blowing up a few like startup mistakes. Like one of the things that I think intimidates people on the entrepreneurial journey is starting and failing, right? This idea of like creating something, it not happening. It's a devastating moment. It's not nice. And that concept puts people off. Speak to us about this, Pedro, particularly this first experience where you said, okay, you actually took investment. The thing didn't work. How did you feel when that happened, and how did you handle it mentally?
No, it's a sucky moment, right? For everyone involved. Nobody likes to fail. I mean, there's a lot of events that celebrate failure, which is great, but you know, it always struck me as awkward and cringy at some point. But you know, like looking back, it was the right thing to do, obviously. The business didn't make sense. The team was okay, but probably wasn't the best one to have a go at it. We were too young and innocent, and also the you know, because of that, the approach we had was a costly one from a financial perspective as well. So it allowed me to think things too. And when I closed that door, that was the moment when new doors open, including landing jobs. So this is the typical, okay, this failed, let's begin another one. I had enough energy to do that because I was younger. So the energy levels were high. I guess if it was now, imagine Talent Protocol failed massively, probably I would need a time off or a sabbatical or something like that. But back then, my energy levels were okay. I was living in a space. Lisbon was already becoming a place that a support network that allows you to fail, you know, kind of like softens the blow, like you failed, so what, you know, let's go. So this sort of thing allows you to keep going. So that was helpful. But yeah, there was that transition, you know, the fact that I was young, lots of energy, and the fact that a new door, a new opportunity opened was great. So it kind of like made me, you know, just, okay, let's jump into another one. That's done. Let's go.
So getting on to the next thing helps you historicize whatever trauma, whatever difficulty mentally you had. You could shut the door and just immediately reinvest your time and energy into that space. You know, you mentioned a few interesting things there, Pedro, particularly about energy levels. And I hate to say it, but youth is a feature of startups, right? And I think a great deal. Obviously, there is a kind of an ageism in tech startup, which is a negative thing. I think we would all agree that's true. But it's also the case that we can't deny that maybe someone at an earlier stage in their career path has simply less like alternative stuff going on in their lives, which means that they can be more resilient or they can take a random risk and not be, you know, have that overloaded pressure. Like for instance, yourself right now, young family, new house, those things don't happen when you're 24, 25, whatever that age, young. You know, you're probably still just bouncing around rental and stuff like this. A lot more like agility in life, so to speak, and less kind of fixed points of responsibility. And I think gives you a competitive advantage, I guess. Let's have a look at the sort of qualities of a CEO. So this is your third time at it, Pedro. You must know by now what you're bad at, right? At this point, you've like got a list of shit where you think, I need someone else to do this. I'm bad at it. What are those things?
Finances is one of them. Not that I don't like them. I do them and all of that. It just doesn't give me any pleasure. Actually, the opposite. It takes some happiness from my body and takes it somewhere in a spreadsheet. And I guess I have a lot of happiness locked up in tabs in many spreadsheets.
That is so true. The Excel is sucking the life force from you. Does everyone else get this? I looked at a lot of spreadsheets today. I filed a bunch of like stuff from accountancy stuff that was like way, way behind on. And it took me 2 hours. I had to take a lie down afterwards. It was like, you know, it wasn't that hard to do. It was literally just checking stuff and signing it. But it was just so, I wouldn't say traumatic, but because obviously I need to do it. But at the same time, it was like the last thing I wanted to do. And if that was something I had to do persistently, totally get it. Like life force training, you know?
It still happens until today. Like yesterday I was doing like a financials retrospective to send to a consulting agency we hired for Talent Protocol to help us like improve financials. So it's like, that was, and this was like lagging, you know, like was lagging in my to-do list. And finally yesterday, like, you know, in one of those moments, like 11:30 PM, okay, I'm going to get this done, you know, whatever the cost. So is that kind of bad, you know, but obviously necessary, obviously fundamental as a CEO, you need to know your numbers game. Obviously you don't like as a CEO, you just don't need to be like a numbers professor or whatever like that. You don't need to enjoy it, you know, and for me personally, I don't. Another thing is, and this is a very recruiting brain food topic, but people debt in a way, it's always going to happen. When you're building a startup, a new company, you're always going to have people debt at some point.
What do you mean by this? So people debt, as I understand, so you've hired someone or you've brought them onto the team.
And, didn't work and out. And now the cost of this, the debt that we incur just because of this is massive because you hired the wrong person right from the start. So it doesn't mean they don't contribute something in between, but you could have hired the right person. So you're already the business, the organization, the community you're building is losing because of this. All right. So that pisses me off. But it comes with the game as well. So it only forced me to be more demanding. And get better at hiring. But is that thing, you know, with hiring, you always know you're bound to make a mistake. And that sucks, knowing this.
But it's also wisdom, isn't it? Like, it's almost like you should plan for a bad hire, which I don't hear many people talk about this, but I wonder whether that's something that's worth doing, because if you could just judge it from a percentile point of view, no matter how good you are, like we're all striving to get better and like eliminate bad hires. Yes, we are all trying to do this, but you can guarantee that you're going to make an error or there will just be a bad circumstance that converts this into a bad hire. You need to have a mitigation strategy. You need to have probably in your own mind, a way in which you can move on quickly from it. So in other words, don't be wrestling around with this bad hire for a prolonged period of time for a lack of knowledge as to what to do about it. So like, have you developed a way to understand when a bad hire is a bad hire? Like, how do you know this? Obviously, at one point you didn't. So when did you confirm in your mind this is not a correctable situation? And what would you, like, what was the process? Have you evolved the process to accelerate through this?
So a lot of questions in there. I think it comes going back to what you're saying before, like when you're young, you know, your life is more, you have less dependencies on your life, so you can take more risks. And, you know, being a founder is one of them. But you also have less experience, right? So especially when it comes down to hiring, assessing people and what works for you, because you also getting to know yourself in a new role. So it's very the risk of making a bad hire when you're a younger founder is a lot higher than when you're older. So I've come to look at three things when I hire someone for a startup. So levels of intelligence, levels of energy, and integrity. These three things are fundamental for me. So this is my mitigation at the starting point. So when making the hire. Also, another thing that helps is also always having a small team mentality, because some hires stop working when your organization gets larger. You know, they were the right people for a certain set, but for a larger one, they aren't. You see this happening in football all the time. You know, the players who do well on a championship league game probably most of them won't do very well in the Premier League, right? So it's something very hard to grasp, and only with experience you'll get there. About mitigation, I've done in the past, you know, hiring someone and then hiring someone else, already thinking on redundancy. So if that person, my confidence levels and looking at these strengths, intelligence, energy, and integrity, I'm not super confident on that person being with us in 1 year and a half. So I do a redundancy hire. Obviously, that is good for business, but also having that mitigation in mind. So it's all this little tricks that you learn from other founders and you learn on your own.
You know what, that idea, Pedro, having a redundancy figure is actually a smart move, irrespective of the quality of the person. Just reminded me, sometimes a great hire could leave your business. In other words, you shouldn't have the mentality that once you've hired someone that's a great person, that's job done, that you've locked down product or you've locked down tech or whatever. For a moment you have, but that person has a life. They have got influences. They have got decisions to make. They may be with you 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. At some point, they may decide to leave. And if you haven't got some contingency in place at that point, then you're going to have to start from scratch. So almost always you should have, this is where flexibility is useful. People who can slide into different roles is useful. Again, using a football analogy, it's almost like, yeah, you want a guy that can play center back, but wouldn't it be great if you could deploy him at fullback as well? Or maybe he can play defensive midfield at a snip. So that sort of flexibility, I think, is maybe something we should also, you know, be conscious of and think about.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about stuff that you're good at, Pedro. You must be good at something. what am I going to get from Pedro as a CEO? Like, what do you do well?
Yeah, I think the things I've mastered along the way. So one is obviously selling/fundraising, which is a fundamental skill for someone who's building a tech startup. So if you're building like a coffee shop, probably fundraising isn't one, but financing is. So it's a different set of skills. I'm not very good at that one. I'm great at fundraising. Also with hiring, you know, we talked about it. So hiring the right people, being able to attract people that worked with you before. So that's, you know, like when I'm hiring like a leader or someone for a leadership position, and this comes with the risk, you know, the real the moment when I know if they're really good or not is if they attract people that they've worked with before, which all right, is hard.
So if they themselves are a hiring asset, it means that they've got good respect, they've built,
yeah,
actually that's a really good measure,
reputation, right? This. But the problem with this measure is you can only measure it after you've hired the person, so which kind of sucks, and that drives me to the redundancy we were talking about before.
I wonder, but anyways, true. Because is it possible not to try and figure out how appealing a person is in industry? You could probably measure like network density, let's say, or I'm thinking, because I used to work for a business that did this, which was trying to measure someone's influence, right, in an industry mm-hmm. sector. And I thought that was quite a clever way. I try to think maybe there's a recruitment angle here. Because if
reference
you hire someone,
check kind of thing, or you could just hire a team altogether. That's a better way to assess this. You know, if you hire a team, then done deal. But yeah, I think there's some way to mitigate this through reference checks and these sort of things. And when I say reference check, not from exactly a human perspective, but also using what you were saying, analyzing like the network graph of that person, you know, how easy, like in previous jobs, did that person, after they moved, did other people move with them? This sort of thing. Right. I think you can make some analysis there. So that's actually a startup idea right there.
I was going to say, this is a good idea. Let's think about this. Like we often have a question, why is this person left? And we rely on this person telling us the truth, or they give us a narrative as to why they left. We don't actually know mm-hmm. that's true. However, maybe it's significant to have a look at did this person leaving, was that contiguous with other people leaving, which tells us maybe that's an environmental issue, or, you know, sometimes if there's a lot of people leaving at one moment, it isn't necessarily an individual performance issue. It's like, okay, there's a systemic change, or there's a cultural change, mm-hmm. or something's happened where a lot of people felt, okay, no longer for me. So as far as I'm aware, that's not analysis that is in any way formalized, but surely we're not too far away from that. You know, it's like we can track this. So yeah, maybe something someone can take a swing at some point. Okay, so you said hiring, you said fundraising, hiring, anything else, or is that it?
That's it, you know. No, I think like, so these two are fundamental, and they're very, you know, they're very correlated. So it's both sales mechanisms for both, just different things, but it comes from the same origin. Having said that, energy, you know, and passion, and so this communication, and again, it comes from the selling or is related to that, but this capacity, both for the community you're building, the team, the investors. So I think that's fundamental, something I have. And, you know, planning. I'm good at planning. I know we talked about the financial, but planning in general. And I guess the last one is integrity. You know, like I do things because I see purpose in them. And even though that doesn't represent integrity 100%, but the way I do things is because I believe in them, not necessarily because I see a market opportunity and, you know, money. It's not money driven. It never was in my life. You can say that's a privilege. Maybe, probably it is. But in this case, I'm taking advantage of that privilege and doing the right thing.
Yeah, always. I totally get it. And as you say, if you are passionate about something, all of those things, actually, it becomes like an amplifier for all of those qualities that you mentioned, right? You're going to be more successful as a fundraiser. Of course, you're going to be more compelling as a recruiter. And, you know, if you're passionate about it, you're going to invest in thinking around these things. You know, I think this is really important. Everyone is correctly a critic of the follow my passion kind of mantra, because that can sometimes lead you down like an unrealistic economic path, right? You see a lot of people following their passion, but they haven't thought about how to build a business around that. And it turns into something that just, like, you can see it's like bleeding down their cash. And it's like, okay, at some point you have to recognize that, because you're gonna be on the street. That's no good. But at the same time, if you're able to think about the productization of it and how it can commercialize, then it makes your entire thing more convincing if you are passionately aligned to it. Like, for instance, for me, recruiting brain food wasn't a I had no passion to, you know, become doing what I'm doing as a thing. But I'm really interested in the idea of like looking at information and finding information and sharing information, right? And that for me makes it like super easy to do. It doesn't feel like work. And I realized because of that, it means that you're much more resilient. You know, the stuff that happens that, you know, disappointing, or things that, you know, your motivation drops for whatever reason, but you still want to do this. It's not like looking at the spreadsheet, right?
Yeah.
It's like stuff you want to do. So
to be honest, like the obvious answer to your previous question was resiliency. Like I have to be a resilient person, but I think all these things drive that. So resiliency is the easy answer to that question. One thing that is important, and I don't want people to get the perception that, you know, you should grind your way to find your purpose, but I think you should give it a shot at some point if you can. Okay. And that's what I was trying to say. Like I was privileged enough that I could build my way, with my passion. And I know that not everyone can do this, but those who can, you know, give it a shot, even if not for the people who can't, you know, at least you're trying.
And at the same time, I have to say it's also a recoverable mistake as well. Let's say it doesn't work. It's rarely decisive, right? You know, I can tell you that first couple of businesses I ran didn't work, but they weren't devastating. It set me back 18 months maybe, but I learned a load that I've now applied to doing things like brain food. So I see it as an investment in education. And you know, with that attitude, it means that whatever error you make, as long as you learn something from it, it actually is a positive type of outcome. Okay, let's move on to talk about a talent protocol. So this is the new thing. When did this start and why did it start? I know you kind of took a break, didn't you? You had a little bit of a, let's decompress, let's have a think through. Like, how did you stumble across talent protocol or as a concept? Like, what's the origin story here? Tell us a bit, little bit about that.
All right, so the backstory to talent protocol. So I've had the core idea of talent protocol for more than 10 years. I cannot really pinpoint the exact year when I started to think about this, but the core idea is there should be a way for people to be vested in each other's careers, right? The thing when 10 years ago, the closest thing to this that I would see was sports. But it had like sports, you have like players, agents, federations, clubs, all these actors interact with each other for an eventual like revenue upside. Okay. But it always struck me as a very zero sum game. So for you to get a Messi or a Cristiano Ronaldo, I mean, there's a lot of players who didn't make it. A lot
millions.
Of
millions, yeah,
millions. All right, so yep. It's a zero sum game, and it never struck me as the way to go at it. Now, Web3 comes in, but how did I get into Web3? I think that's also the backstory to this, because the backstory of the idea is this one. The backstory to get into Web3 is another one. So, I was building landing.jobs, which is a tech recruitment marketplace, kind of like hire.com, but focused in Portugal, Spain, Germany, recruitment and payments as well. And I was at it for eight point five plus years with almost 3 years stay in London where we kind of like connected there. And then also Amsterdam in the end. And it's just reached a point where I could do a couple more tours of duty on landing jobs, but my energy levels were low. My passion was still there, but not as the same as in the beginning. And more importantly than that, we have built a executive structure that allowed me to take a step back, be part of the board as a non-exec. So obviously the decision came through me. I talked with my co-founder, who's staying, by the way, he's a finances guy. You've met Paiva, he's a finances guy. So it's good that we always, we always complemented each other from an age perspective, but also from, a skill perspective as well. So he's staying, we got Diogo as the CEO, as his active team there as well. So I was privileged again. I'm using the word privilege a lot, but I was indeed, I don't have a better word for it, that I was able to do this step. And I'm saying this based on data as well, because when I did it, I had other founders calling me and asking me, how do you do it? How can do you think I can do it myself? Because
so how do
what
you
happens,
step away? You had
how do you step away?
Wow. So
there's a lot of founders.
Freeze frame here, because this is interesting. You're saying there's a lot of founders that don't know how to step away.
They're stuck with their baby, because they don't have, they haven't built a structure, or the business is not there yet. And there's a lot of founders who are, for instance, myself, I'm better at the beginning of a company than, obviously the kicking it off, understanding what to build, the initial growth. But later growth is just doesn't drive my passion, right? So, and there's a lot of founders like this. So they contacted me, and I tried to help some of them. But it's not an easy thing, and in most cases they're just stuck. There's no way out, and it sucks.
Now that you mention that, there's people floating in my mind that even though they won't say, it's like I kind of know that they've stopped enjoying this. They want to move on. But as you say, like, it's keeping them there. I guess it's like some cost fallacy, right? They've already put stuff in. there may be actually legal implications for them.
There's legal implications. They're stuck. I mean, they really would love to be able to move out. Even, you know, when I say move out, it's like be involved with the company, but start something new. But it's just not going to happen. So I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. So on the 1st of January last year, I started my sabbatical. There's a really cool site, learningsabbatical.com, which kind of like gives you a heavy framework for what a sabbatical is. Well, I kind of made the lean version of that. So I had two things, like a learning plan and an accountability buddy. And that's it. So I learned a few things that I wanted to learn for a long time. But, you know, when you're building a startup or even like as an operator, you're in focused mode. And what a sabbatical allows you is to go on diffuse mode and your brain is just let loose. So I learned psychology, learning how to learn, finances as well, even though that was the most sucky topic I learned. It was also something that was I felt as necessary. And thank God I did the learning how to learn before, because it allowed me to learn better the financial.
That's the first thing you should do, right?
Learning how to learn. The first one. But yeah. I did the psychology one first and then the learning how to learn, which was a good combination as well. And then the finance and then blockchain. And when I was going deeper and deeper into blockchain, actually coding a bit on Solidity, which is almost like JavaScript. And, you know, my background is computer science, so I've built distributed systems before. Blockchain is just, you know, the novelty of technology and economy coming together in the distributed system and solving a very old problem, the Byzantine general problem, where they needed to find a way to trust each other and cooperate with each other to save the empire. Guess what? They were never able to fix that, and the empire wasn't saved, even though it lasted for a long time. I learned blockchain and Web3 as a movement, as a revolution in a way, and I kind of fell down the rabbit hole. I don't like to say this, but it happened, and that's when I realized when I was going deeper and deeper in this space and falling in love with it and getting that energy back, that passion back, I realized one day, I can actually coin, not today, but the moment it happened was I was watching this podcast called All In Podcast, and they were talking about decentralization of society. And I think it was Shamat, he says decentralization of something, and then Jason says careers. And that's the moment where that old memory, so the synapses between my brain cells started to go really fast. And that happened. That was the moment when, you know, like, I think we can build this with the Web3 approach. So instead of zero-sum games, having a collective success approach. And, you know, Talent Protocol today, just for people listening, essentially is a Web3 professional network where high potential individuals can build an on-chain resume and launch their own talent token. And this way they allow anyone to easily invest in their careers and build these support networks around themselves. So that's what we're building with Talent Protocol. So if anyone listening wants to have a go at our private beta, let me know. I'll on Twitter or something, PCBO on Twitter, I'll send you an invite to test it out.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that story, Pedro, particularly how, you know, these sometimes you can almost like have these old mental notes stored away somewhere. And that you know, you may think that, okay, here's just an idea that didn't emerge, but it just needed the moment to emerge.
Yeah.
And it needed maybe the infusion of more information in the context of this sabbatical. I totally agree with you. If you're in the middle of a business or a job that's very intensive, you just don't have the mind space for things to allow in. In fact, you become very defensive with your mind space, and you start like removing things because you know you need focus in order to execute on your job. And that often means that you miss opportunity or you miss the opportunity to connect those synapses. Probably one thing we should do is actually try and like deliberately engineer time where there's nothing going on. You know, so you engineer spaces in your day where randomness can occur, and these you can try and recreate the random connections mm-hmm. without trying, so to speak. So this is now going into, you know, some weird deep Eastern philosophy perhaps, but it, you know, if you try too hard, you ain't gonna do it. You got to let it empty, and then things might just wander in there, and that's how you might, you know, quote unquote get lucky, but really you're putting the pieces together and allowing something to fire.
It's actually interesting, because one of the best techniques to really learn new things, and going back into learning how to learn, is actually, you know, to have this combination of focus and diffuse moments. So for instance, when you're sleeping, that's the moment when your brain cells start making connections, weird connections. So remember, everyone remembers like a weird dream or something like that. That's just the brain making connections that you wouldn't make that connection in focus mode. So we have to combine to learn really proficiently. You have to combine the focus mode with repetition, with visual memorization, all these things, with the diffuse mode. That is kind of like the gluing things together, especially different concepts. So when you're learning new, very different things, it's important to have relaxation moments. That's why, you know, especially for kids at school, don't learn on the day before, because you don't have this relaxation moment that allows you to really incorporate the teachings that you've just learned. So yeah, sorry about the
I thought that was a wonderful segue. You just inspired me. I should like be a, I'm gonna do some painting or something. You know, because I don't do anything creative. I've realized that I'm pretty much focused, and then I'm like knocked out.
You know, exercise is a good thing.
I don't
as well.
Do that either. There's lots of crap right. I need to do, man. Holy crap! Had a chat with a friend of mine today. She was on like Bondi Beach in Sydney, right? So I think I might be going to Sydney for a bit. She was giving me this like video call. Look at this beach. I thought, holy shit, I need to get into shape. All of these Bondi beach bodies are walking around. I thought, oh my god, if I'm actually going to go there, you know, I can't be going with a body like this. I need to like step this game up. So yeah, I got hyper motivation to get fit. But anyway, let's talk about sort of the assembly of the talent protocol team. So, okay, you had this like revelation. You wanted to do this. At what point do you think, okay, maybe I need to do it with other people? Because I know you've always founded with others. But was there a moment where you thought, maybe I do this myself? Or was it always in your mind, you know what, I need to assemble a crew here? And if it was the latter, like how did you find those people?
It was a very organic process. So because I know a lot of solo founders, and the struggles they go through. So in principle, I think I have a preconception of not doing that, even though I have never like put it aside, but it just organically wouldn't happen. So what happened was, actually, I just done like a branding project for a community I run, which is CTO Portugal. It's a safe space for tech leaders to talk shit about recruiters. Sorry, it's not that, but it's a safe space for tech leaders who call Portugal home. And the people don't talk about recruiters. Don't worry about it. And when they do, it's always good things. And having said that, I've just done like a rebranding project for CTO Portugal with Philippe, my co-founder and CMO, and he just led his company end of last year. So we actually had a very similar timeline, very different careers, but a very similar timeline. So I stopped being an executive on landing jobs on the 1st of January, and he stopped being an executive on his previous branding, marketing and branding agency, Common, is the name, Come On, on the 1st of January. So he was going at it with a freelancing for 4-6 months, and then a sabbatical. He was going to do one. And we did this project together. I really liked that approach. I knew him for a long time. We always kept in touch. So I always liked this. His communication, his branding skills, which I think when I had the idea, I felt like we're talking about talent. We need to tell these stories, kind of like Humans of New York kind of thing. We need to tell stories. It's interesting because he then created like a side project called Humans of Web3. So he's that kind of guy. So when I talked to him about it, and it's funny because if you ask him, and he confessed this to me, when I told, look, I have this thing I just wanted to run your mind through. Obviously, it was a pitch to bring him in, but I didn't say it like that. You never do, especially in founder dating. It's a soft approach, right? And he confessed to me afterwards that he was prepared. He already thought to himself that he was going to tell me no to whatever was coming. So he was ready to tell me no, but obviously he didn't. So the day after, because what he wanted to do with this sabbatical was to build a community of people to follow him throughout his sabbatical. And Talent Protocol is that, but at scale for everyone with a new economy built on top. And I think that was the trigger, like, damn, okay, so his sabbatical was off. My sabbatical was over as well. So I was planning for a 12-month. It ended up being, you know, 3 months. So I still owe myself 9 months. And it's funny because if you go on my profile on Talent Protocol, you can see there that I want to step down as CEO. Until 2024, not necessarily for a new CEO to come through, but to decentralize our team, our core team, to the community. So we can go deeper into those mechanics of community. Not sure if you have much time, but I just wanted to say, like, Philippe was the first choice, and then we had Andreas that was thinking about something similar for his own business. He started as our co-founder and CTO. He has moved back to just co-founder, and which is fine. He's still helping us with our treasury. But I mean, it was an organic process, to answer your question. It just happened.
Right. Yeah, but I think the organic process is kind of the foundational layer behind that is just an awareness that maybe to truck on by yourself is it just takes a different way to do it, and maybe for something technical is actually very difficult to do. I think part of the smarts that you've accrued over time is basically be aware that building a network and building a community is actually a really useful way to identify potential future partners in what you're doing. The worst thing I think you can do is not invest in this and then, you know, maybe have a great idea, but then you're hunting around for a co-founder. And you see this like on Hacker News and stuff, don't you? I'm looking for a co-founder and they spec it out and it's like, oh my goodness, like I get it. But you'd be searching for this like a needle in a haystack. And you might find that needle, but that needle might not like you. Like the chances of you just hitting this off are so low.
Founder recruiting or dating is the hardest form of recruiting there exists. And especially the values have to be aligned. So many things have to be aligned. And there's a reason why a lot of startups fail because of founders' issues. That's real. That's why a lot of people go solo, but then solo has a lot of other problems as well. So I think, you know, there was a mental framework that I used and I was kind of like aware of it, but it just happened so naturally that I didn't even think about it for real. You know, I didn't write it down like a process or something like that.
Yeah, but it's like an implicit framework that you have and that you practice in your mind rather than formalized, let's say. So,
there's another thing that I think it's relevant, and especially in Web3, there is very different compared to Web2 when building a startup. Look, the mechanics are different, like tokens versus equity. There's, you know, all these fundamentals are different. But there's one thing that I find it very different, which is teams. And you see this all the time in unicorns, and I see this on landing jobs as well, and other companies. You have very large teams, and. In Web3, the it's impressive the quantity of projects that you just have like a very small team behind it, which is
what triggers that? Like what is the thing that makes that the case?
I think we are drinking from the same chalice as open source, which is usually, you know, small teams as well. And also decentralization. Why would you build like a super massive large team when in the end you're exiting to the community? Doesn't make sense, right? It's like getting fat really fast and then getting thin really fast. It's not healthy, right? So you build a very small, in our case, on Talent Protocol, up to 9 people core team. We even have a joke, an internal joke, which is we're kind of like the Lord of the Rings, the 9 rings given to men that are bound to die. So this team is bound to die. And it's a 9 people team. And this team will cease to exist at some point. I have in my personal roadmap that it needs to happen until 2024. I hope by then I will make a community proposal that will be voted, in our governance forum by the community, by the token holders, and it goes forward to reduce this team to a very small leadership team, like 2, 3, maximum 4 people leading the community. Because that's the purpose of decentralization, like having lots of contributors that, code, do translate articles and whatever the needs of the community are, they do it and that they get paid for it in their own community economy token. So it's a whole different way of thinking about metrics, of thinking about society, of thinking about economy, teams, talent. So it just changes the whole mindset. And when, for instance, for me, it's very hard nowadays to go back into like a board meeting of landing jobs. I have to readjust my mindset to a Web2 process where I look into profitability, revenue, these sort of things. When I go into Talent Protocol, it's about things like TVL, which is total value locked in the protocol, and other metrics that are important that we're measuring in public. And so I think it comes from open source, but it evolved on its own now. And I'm still figuring it out as well. So the thing about Web2 is that nobody really knows what's happening. We kind of have like this vision, collective vision of where things are going. But if someone tells you they know what Web3 is going to be about, they're lying to your face. They don't, nobody knows.
Yeah, it's an emerging space. But what is interesting about this is that the economics of Web3 are determining the social structures and the behaviors on top of it. So if you want to take like a Marxist view of it, whether you have the infrastructure economics and you have the superstructure in terms of culture, the infrastructure with regards to Web3 is decentralization. It's using token economics. Ultimately, the emergent structures on top of that people organically build are vastly different from what you might expect if it's based on, as you say, Web2 mechanics. When you mention, okay, Web2, typically you might grow a big team. It kind of makes sense because what is the end objective to this group? It's ultimately to try and squeeze more efficiency, more value out of the thing that you're trying to get out of, is particularly when you're interacting with an external market. Whereas in a decentralized type of platform, for the folks who are listening to this, I'll just summarize real quick, but the plan is ultimately to exit to the community itself, right? So that is the clear objective, which means, if you like, almost a decomposition of the business, if that makes any sense to the folks listening to this. There's in Web2, that would make no sense to think, I'm going to create this mega organization and ultimately decompose it. That's the plan. No one's going to back that. But in Web3, that's basically what you want to try and do.
Just to compliment in there, there were formats in Web2 that were similar to what happens in Web3, but the underlying economic value system just wasn't working. So you had like the Shamrock organization where you can even pay users to do some sort of service to your organization. But in the end, it's a shareholder owned approach, and the other one is a user owned approach, and this makes the whole difference in this space. It's game changer, when you fall down in the Web3 rabbit hole, you kind of get it. It's not about revenue; it's about ownership.
Yeah. And, and it- It's a deep sort of shift. It's not like an accoutrement from the previous. It really is a revolutionary shift. And now you have this situation where I think Web3, someone asked me a question about this and saying, oh, yeah, should we write about blockchain? I said, listen, if you're not already, you know, you're a Web2 company, the last thing you want to do is commentate on the outside about this. The reality of it is any Web2 company right now is not building anything particularly interesting with regards to blockchain. The things that are happening in Web3 are Web3 startups. So in other words, I see it very much as like a dissident movement outside of Web2. It's not coming out of, you don't see a big bank do anything interesting. You don't see governments do anything interesting. It's all coming from—
A lot of legacy. They just can't innovate at the pace that crypto native startups and right. builders can. I think like we're reaching the last 5 minutes. I cannot go away without giving you, like you, the audience, like the recruiting brain food. What I believe is going to be the fundamental shift for talent. You know, what were we talking about? Web 2, Web 3 comparison. So Web 2 careers about salary, Web 2 talents about ownership. Web 2 careers about credentials. We talked about it in the beginning. Web 3 talents about contributions. And it's on chain, so we all know what you've contributed to the multiple communities you're part of. Web 2 is about competition. Web 3 is about cooperation. Web 2 is about scarcity. Web 3 is about abundance. And this can be seen in many different ways. So I look at careers in Web 2 as kind of like, obviously, you're no longer working for one company your whole life, so you're changing. So you're changing, but it's like a single thread. In Web3, it's like multi-thread. So you can be working for two, three organizations at the same time and creating links between them. So it's seen, it's very interesting. In Web3, it's actually appreciated that if you add other projects besides the one that you're working on. This is a fundamental mindset shift.
It's more than the fundamental mindset shift, because actually in Web 2, you are typically prevented from doing a supplementary other stuff.
Like contractually prevented. Yeah, exactly.
There'll be calls in employment contract saying you can't work for anybody else. If you do, we own that IP or something, right?
So it's look, like, oh, shit. Like our team on Talent Protocol, like... I have people working on NFTs, like projects on the side. Philippe is doing the Humans of Web3. I got CTO Portugal. So it's even though it's not a Web3 thing, but it's appreciated that we do this. And that's a fundamental shift. And there's two more things. So Web2 is about silos. And what you mentioned about like companies growing, their structure, it's in a siloed approach. I mean, they don't... The economics aren't right for them to build with their community. Even there's like though there's like companies like, for instance, Notion, they do have a brilliant community around them. But you know, what are they winning with Notion growth? You know, when Notion sells it to Google or whatever, do they get some? They don't. You know, like so this silo approach makes sense. In Web3, it's composability. Is what you were saying. Things are basically building projects so that they are integrated with each other. So this composability is fundamental instead of a siloed approach. And last but not least, I think we're going from an employer-centric approach to a talent-centric approach. Through landing jobs, I was able to deep dive into the HR tech world, which I'm still very involved until today. And recruiting brain food is a massive component of this personal growth that I've had. Props to you, Hung. And I've seen a lot of platforms being built that are like talent first or talent centric, but the economic value system that is supporting those experiences is still an employer driven one. So even though we have, especially in tech, a market that is, you know, in favor of talent, the economic value systems are employer-driven. So we have to make that shift as well. And that's fundamentally one of the things we're doing with Talent Protocol with Talent Tokens, is putting talent at the head of the table, and letting this economic value systems of built around talent reconstruct themselves. And I'll shut up, but I did my brainwash.
No need to shut up. Actually, one of you, I had a fan line, actually. So obviously, this is a conversation that could last for much longer than the hour we have.
Yes.
But let's wrap it up with this final question, which is people listening to this, they're saying, okay, this is quite interesting. Like, if they were if they're going to type in talentprotocol.com right now, and you invited them in, they got into the community, what would they be able to do? They'd be able to buy tokens and invest in people, or would they be able to volunteer themselves as people that might be tokenized? How does that work? Can you quickly describe their experience?
So they can either launch their token or they can buy someone else's token. They can claim other people's perks as well. They can get in touch with each other to our messaging system. There's a lot of organic stuff happening beyond the platform. So people doing this accountability newsletters every quarter or every month to their token holders. So we're not exactly controlling that, but it's some behavior we want to capitalize on, or at least support that through product. On the community side, you can join our Discord. There's some bounties available. So there's all these community dynamics that we do, that we enable. And also there's product office hours every week. There's community call, a couple of them every month. So we approved a bunch of product growth and community developments between March and June, which is our season, our second season. We're building in seasons, by the way. We didn't mention this, but it's a form of iterations. And so that was approved with our community, and now we're proposing our tokenomics, which is the token economical mechanics for season two as well in a couple of weeks. And let's see what kind of feedback we get from the community. So it's building in public, because I don't see any other way of doing this in Web3, to be honest.
That's fantastic. Like I say, if you're interested in the future of recruiting, if you're interested in the future of technology and recruiting, then this is definitely a product that you should pay attention to. In fact, a decent entryway into other topics in Web3. If for instance, you struggle a little bit to understand the potential applications of blockchain, this is, I think, a good example of what might be happening in our space. So talentprotocol.com, do check it out. Okay, Pedro, I will leave you right there. What's the busy stuff you have to get involved in now? You're gonna take a nap or something? What's happening after this call?
I was thinking about gym and then lunch, or fitness, kickboxing. Let me, but maybe that's better at the end of the day. So I don't know. I need 5 minutes to think about it.
Yeah, decompress and then beat someone up or eat some fish or something, right? So I dig it. That's a decent way to spend a couple of hours in the afternoon. Okay, Pedro Oliveira, thank you so much for your time, man. Really great chatting with you. Great to catch up also. And thanks for joining us on Founders Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Wasn't that great? He is one of my favorite people. Really smart, very passionate dude, and good luck in this project. Fascinating stuff. Okay, folks, that's about it. We've got a long series of Founders Focuses, by the way. Loads of CEOs are they're knocking down my door to get onto this program. We're going to keep doing them probably every week, probably every Wednesday. In the meantime, we're going to do Brain Food Live on Friday. We're talking about shifting. Should TA shift from HR to somewhere else or reintegrate into HR? We're going to have a great debate on that. So make sure you sign up, follow the channel if you are interested in this. All right, folks, that's it. You have a very good weekend. Middle of the week. You have a very good Wednesday.